Welcome to Counting to Five, a new weekly podcast about the United States Supreme Court. On today's episode, as we await the start of the new Supreme Court term, we're going to talk about the current state of the court, including the prospects for filling the seat left vacant by the death of Justice Scalia. We'll take a whirlwind tour of the cases the court has already granted for the upcoming term, and we'll take a look at what some of the justices have been up to lately. But before we get to that, let's talk about the term itself. According to federal statute, the Supreme Court's term officially begins each year on the first Monday in October. By tradition, the court typically begins its first sitting to hear oral arguments on that day. This year, because that Monday is Rosh Hashanah, the court will hear its first arguments on Tuesday, October 4th. Each month, from October through April, the court has a two-week sitting to hear oral arguments. The court issues opinions throughout the term as they are finished, but wraps up the term by issuing the last opinions by the end of June. The court is then in recess from July through September, and the justices go their separate ways for the summer. Of course, none of this is set in stone, and occasionally the court will do something different. For example, the Supreme Court originally heard oral argument in the famous and controversial Citizens United case in March of 2009, but rather than issuing an opinion by the end of June as expected, the court instead ordered a second oral argument on September 9th of that year, and ultimately issued its decision in January of 2010. But that's the exceptional case, and normally we can expect the court to hand down decisions for all of the term's cases by the end of June before the summer recess. And although the court is officially in recess for the summer, that doesn't mean nothing's happening there. Throughout the summer, as the need arises, the court issues occasional orders, often ruling on requests for a stay of a lower court's order. For example, on September 13th, the court ruled on two requests for stays of lower court rulings. First, in Ferrer v. Senate Subcommittee on Investigations, the court refused a request from the CEO of Backpage.com, an online classified ad service, to stay a ruling from the D.C. District Court ordering Backpage to comply with a subpoena from the U.S. Senate. And second, in Ohio Democratic Party v. Husted, the court refused a request from the Ohio Democratic Party to stay a Sixth Circuit decision that upheld certain changes to Ohio's election laws, including the elimination of an extra 5 days of early voting. Most recently, on September 21st, the court granted a stay of a Ninth Circuit ruling in Dignity Health v. Rollins, a case asking whether health care plans provided by nonprofit employee benefit companies to religious organizations, including hospitals, can count as church plans which are exempt from certain requirements of the Affordable Care Act. The Ninth Circuit's decision, which went against the health plan provider Dignity Health, is stayed pending a decision on its petition for the Supreme Court to take the case. There are also two other similar petitions pending before the court. There's no guarantee that the court will decide to take any of these cases, but the fact that the stay was issued is a sign that the court is strongly considering it. And the justices' clerks, the often unacknowledged workhorses of the Supreme Court, don't get the summer off. They've been hard at work preparing for the October oral arguments and reviewing petitions for certiorari. These are the formal requests for the Supreme Court to take cases, referred to as cert petitions for short, which continue to pour into the court year-round. The circuit courts, the federal courts of appeals that feed the Supreme Court many of its cases, hear oral arguments and issue opinions year-round. But the Supreme Court, unlike the lower federal courts, has the luxury of controlling its own docket. With very limited exceptions, the court gets to choose the cases it wants to hear, and hears and decides them on its own schedule. So where does the court stand as we enter the new term? Since the unexpected death of Justice Antonin Scalia in February, the Supreme Court has been an eight-person body. Scholars and court watchers will undoubtedly be debating Justice Scalia's legacy for years to come, and the short and long-term effects of his replacement remain to be seen, but certain immediate effects of Scalia's death have already been apparent. Most obviously, in four cases last term, the court was deadlocked 4-4, and as a result issued no opinions and affirmed the decisions below without setting any new precedents. And in a fifth case, Nevada v. Hall, the court was partially deadlocked and issued no decision on one of the issues before it. And these deadlocks include some high-profile cases, like United States v. Texas, the challenge to President Obama's Deferred Action for Parents of Americans program, DAPA for short, which would have granted deferred action to unauthorized immigrants who are the parents of a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident. The case was fast-tracked to the Supreme Court after a U.S. district judge granted a preliminary injunction putting a halt to the DAPA program. Because the court split 4-4, the injunction remains in effect for the time being, but without any definitive resolution from the High Court. On the other hand, in Fisher v. University of Texas, the challenge to the university's affirmative action program, Justice Elena Kagan was recused due to her involvement with the case in her former position as Solicitor General, leaving, after Scalia's death, only 7 participating justices. The court upheld the constitutionality of the University of Texas's program by a vote of 4-3, but it seems likely that the case would have turned out differently with Justice Scalia in the mix, perhaps with a 4-4 tie or a different compromise decision. Scalia's death had other less obvious impacts. In Zubik v. Burwell, a consolidated challenge by several religious nonprofits to the enforcement of the Department of Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate, the 8-member court unanimously remanded the cases to their respective lower courts for further consideration in light of a proposed compromise floated by the court. This attempt to reach a compromise solution, a highly unusual step for the Supreme Court, was widely viewed by commentators as an attempt to avoid what would otherwise have been another 4-4 tie. Another thing likely affected by Justice Scalia's death is the size and makeup of the court's docket for the upcoming term. Typically, the court hears somewhere in the ballpark of 70 cases each term, and usually the court has already granted about half of those cases by the end of June, with the rest added after the start of the new term. This year, the court has granted only 29 cases so far, which is low compared to the last few years. Why is the number of cases granted low? No one but the justices knows for sure, but we can engage in some educated speculation. First, it may just be a result of the court's decreased size. It takes the votes of 4 justices to grant certiorari, so one fewer justice voting means fewer cases crossing the 4-vote threshold. Although the number of cases granted is low compared to the average over the last few years, it's actually only slightly below last year when the court was at full size, and not unprecedented in the last decade. 2007 was lower. So it's possible that this alone could account for the low numbers. But there are other plausible explanations. First, the justices may have been deliberately avoiding cases where they think they may end up divided 4-4, either because they don't want to waste the time and resources on a case that won't result in an opinion, or because they want to avoid the institutional embarrassment that comes with being unable to decide a case. Second, and perhaps more cynically, even if the justices anticipate that they'll have a ninth justice in time to hear some of the term's cases, they may be hesitant to take cases they expect to be closely divided until they know who the new justice will be and have some idea how the case will come out. In other words, until they know whether they'll be able to count to 5. There's at least some evidence that the court is taking the risk of 4-4 splits into consideration in its scheduling of oral arguments for the cases already granted. The court usually schedules cases for argument roughly in the order they're granted. This isn't exact. For example, the court will sometimes shuffle cases around in order to hear argument in cases raising related issues on the same day. But that's the rough practice. This year, 3 of the earliest cases granted for the term, all granted on January 15th, before Justice Scalia's death, have not been scheduled for oral argument, even though a number of cases granted as late as June 28th are already on the calendar for the November sitting. These 3 cases involve Fifth Amendment takings claims, class action civil procedure, and religious liberties claims, all areas that have sharply divided the court in the past. Court watchers have speculated that the court is deliberately holding back cases anticipated to be close, in hopes that by the time they're scheduled, the court will have a ninth justice. This will definitely be something to keep an eye on when the court releases its December argument calendar, which should be within the next few weeks. So let's take a closer look at the current vacancy. On the morning of February 13th, Justice Scalia was found dead of natural causes. Almost immediately, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell issued a statement saying that the Senate should not confirm a new Supreme Court justice until after the next presidential election. A little over a month later, on March 16th, President Obama nominated D.C. Circuit Chief Judge Merrick Garland to replace Justice Scalia. Since then, although some Republican senators have agreed to meet with Garland, McConnell and other Republican leaders have held firm and Garland has not been given a confirmation hearing. Although it hasn't happened in several decades, lengthy Supreme Court vacancies are not unprecedented. As of this recording, the seat has been vacant for over 220 days. Justice Kennedy's confirmation in 1988 was 237 days after the retirement of Justice Lewis Powell, and Justice Harry Blackmun wasn't confirmed until 391 days after Justice Abe Fortas's resignation in 1969. But Garland now holds the record for the longest time between nomination and confirmation rejection or withdrawal, beating the previous record by almost 70 days so far, and by all indications he'll continue to extend his lead at least until Election Day. During this time, Garland has been getting something of an extended vacation from his job on the D.C. Circuit. When a sitting federal judge is nominated to the Supreme Court, they normally stop hearing cases pending confirmation to avoid having to recuse themselves later if any of those cases end up before the Supreme Court. Garland has made a few public appearances recently. On August 26th, Garland gave a talk to entering law students at Harvard Law School, and on September 20th, he gave a talk at Howard University Law School as part of that school's Constitution Day activities. Videos of both of these appearances are available online. But how will the vacant seat ultimately be filled? Obviously, no one knows, but there are several possible scenarios depending on the results of the election. First, if Hillary Clinton is elected, Republican senators may act to confirm Merrick Garland before the end of the year in the lame duck session. Several Republican senators, including Judiciary Committee Chair Chuck Grassley, have stated that they are open to considering confirmation hearings for Garland during the lame duck session. Many Republicans view Garland as one of the best nominations they're likely to get from a Democratic president, and once the prospect of altogether blocking a Democratic appointee is off the table, they may want to lock in Garland. For her part, Clinton has stated that if she's elected, she will not necessarily renominate Merrick Garland. Some have viewed this as an implicit warning to Republican senators that if they don't confirm Garland, they're likely to get someone they like even less. On the other hand, in a recent Bloomberg News column, Harvard Law Professor Noah Feldman has argued that short-term political incentives make it unlikely that Republicans will confirm Garland in the lame duck session. And there's always the possibility that President Obama could block this move by withdrawing Garland's nomination after a Clinton election win, though most observers seem to think this is unlikely. So if Garland isn't confirmed and Clinton is elected, who will she nominate? Clinton hasn't said, although a short list of likely contenders has been making the rounds based on supposedly well-connected insiders. The list consists of 9 state and federal judges, along with 2 sitting U.S. senators. And what if Donald Trump is elected? Back in May, Trump released a list of 11 names of state and federal judges that he said he would consider appointing to the court. The announcement was intended to reassure conservative voters that Trump would appoint a reliably conservative judge. Only hours after releasing the list, however, Trump left the door open by saying that he would also consider appointing people not on the list, but close in spirit to those who are. Just last week, a rumor made the rounds that Trump had promised to appoint billionaire PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel to the Supreme Court. Thiel is a prominent Trump supporter who gave a high-profile speech at the Republican National Convention. The rumor was quickly denied by spokespeople for both Trump and Thiel. Then, on Friday, September 23rd, Trump released a new list of 10 additional names to supplement his original list of 11. This time, however, Trump promised that his eventual nominee would definitely be selected from this combined list of 21 names. The name that has been getting the most attention is Senator Mike Lee, the only non-judge on Trump's list. Interestingly, Lee has been a vocal Trump critic and has stated that this new list doesn't change his views on Trump. Finally, there has been some speculation about what could happen in the unlikely scenario where Trump wins the presidency, but the Democrats take control of the Senate. Because the new Senate is seated on January 3rd, but the presidential inauguration doesn't occur until the 20th, it's conceivable that President Obama could renominate Garland or nominate some other candidate, and the new Democratic Senate majority could try to quickly push through the confirmation before Trump takes office by invoking the so-called nuclear option to prevent a filibuster by the Republican minority. Of course, until the election, this is all pure speculation, but it will be interesting to see how the confirmation process plays out over the next several months. As a final note, although the political left has been largely united in pushing for Garland's confirmation to the court, Georgia State University law professor Eric Siegel recently published an interesting contrarian piece in the Daily Beast, arguing that the court is better off with only 8 members. Siegel argues that when the court is divided 4-4 on the most controversial issues, it is forced to seek compromises and narrow rulings which should be viewed as a benefit. The lack of a 9th member leads to 4-4 ties on only a small number of cases, and even there, the national legal uniformity that only the Supreme Court can provide is rarely that important. It seems doubtful that many on the left will be convinced by Siegel's argument, but it's definitely an interesting perspective to consider. Now let's turn from the court's membership to the cases we know it's going to be hearing this term. The court has agreed to hear 29 cases, covering a variety of areas of law, but so far, it doesn't look like it's shaping up to be a term filled with blockbusters. Although, of course, that can change as the court fills out the rest of its calendar. That said, there are a number of cases dealing in one way or another with racial issues, and one potentially controversial religious liberty case. On later episodes of this podcast, I'll be delving into the term's cases in greater detail, but for today, I'm just going to provide a rapid-fire overview of all 29 cases currently before the court. First, the court has several cases dealing with criminal law and criminal procedure. 2 cases deal with the scope of particular criminal offenses. In Shaw v. United States, the court needs to decide, under a federal statute criminalizing defrauding a financial institution, whether the bank actually has to be the victim of the fraud, or is it enough that the bank was deceived in the course of obtaining money from someone else? In Salmon v. United States, the court will look at the insider trading laws and decide whether, in order to prosecute someone who leaks insider information, it is necessary that the tipper received some tangible benefit for the information, or is it enough that they merely wanted the tip recipient to benefit from the information? A few cases deal with constitutional questions surrounding criminal procedure and sentencing. In Peña-Rodriguez v. Colorado, the court will consider whether a criminal defendant must be allowed to introduce jury testimony showing that jury deliberations were tainted by racial bias. This case pits strong rules and norms about not looking behind a jury's deliberations against the Sixth Amendment's right to an impartial jury. In Bravo Fernandez v. United States, the court will consider the scope of the Fifth Amendment's protection against double jeopardy. If a defendant is acquitted of some charges but convicted of others, and the convictions are later thrown out, when determining how broad of a protection against double jeopardy the jury's acquittals provide, can a court consider the fact that the jury voted to convict on other counts, even though those convictions were ultimately thrown out? And in Moore v. Texas, the court will revisit the issue of the execution of persons with intellectual disabilities. The court has held that the 8th Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment prohibits the execution of the intellectually disabled. In Moore, the court will consider to what extent a state's criteria for determining intellectual disability needs to line up with current medical standards. The court will also hear Manrique v. United States, a case about criminal appeals. Specifically, when a criminal defendant appeals a judgment of imprisonment that also requires the payment of an undetermined amount in restitution, and then the court subsequently enters an order setting the amount of restitution, does the defendant need to file a second notice of appeal to challenge the amount of restitution, or does the earlier notice of appeal do the job? The court will also hear two habeas corpus cases. Habeas corpus is the process for bringing a new action to challenge an earlier criminal conviction or sentence. In order to appeal the denial of a habeas corpus petition, the petitioner needs to ask the court for a certificate of appealability, essentially the court's determination that the appeal raises a legitimate issue. In Buck v. Davis, the Supreme Court will consider whether lower courts have been too stingy in granting certificates of appealability, and specifically, whether the improper introduction of racial stereotypes into sentencing was an issue worthy of appeal. In Beckles v. United States, the court will consider whether its 2015 decision in Johnson v. United States, which struck down a portion of the Armed Career Criminals Act as impermissibly vague, applies retroactively to cases that were already final before Johnson was decided. The court has two cases related to immigration and naturalization on its docket. In Jennings v. Rodriguez, the court will decide whether due process requires the government to provide a bond hearing for unauthorized immigrants who have been detained by the Department of Homeland Security for more than 6 months. And in Lynch v. Morales-Santana, the court will consider whether equal protection is violated by rules governing when the foreign-born child of an unwed U.S. citizen parent gets citizenship that differ depending on whether the U.S. citizen parent was the father or the mother. The court will hear several cases related to remedies for the violation of constitutional and statutory rights. In Manuel v. City of Joliet, the court will consider whether the Fourth Amendment allows a claim for malicious prosecution following a wrongful arrest. In Fry v. Napoleon Community Schools, the court will look at the interaction between the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, the IDEA, and the Handicapped Children's Protection Act. Specifically, the court will ask to what extent parents must exhaust all of the procedures under the IDEA before bringing an action under the ADA when the relief they are seeking is money damages, which aren't provided by the IDEA. In Ivy v. Morath, another ADA case, the court will consider whether ADA provisions regulating services provided by public entities apply to services provided by private businesses under the authority of the public entity. And in two consolidated cases, Wells Fargo & Co. v. City of Miami and Bank of America Corp. v. City of Miami, the court will determine whether a city can qualify as an aggrieved person who can bring an action for discriminatory lending practices under the Fair Housing Act due to indirect harms to the city like decreased tax revenues. The court has two cases relating to pleading standards. Venezuela v. Helmerich & Payne International deals with the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, the FSIA, which protects foreign governments from being sued in U.S. courts. The FSIA has an exception for property seized in violation of international law, and the court will determine what a plaintiff needs to plead to invoke this exception. And in the consolidated cases Visa Inc. v. Osborne and Visa Inc. v. Stumbos, the court will consider to what extent businesses' membership and participation in an industry association can support an inference of an antitrust conspiracy. The court has one case dealing with the False Claims Act. The FCA allows private individuals, referred to as relators, to bring actions against people for defrauding the federal government, and if they are successful, to keep some of the recovered money. FCA actions must be initially filed under seal. In State Farm Fire and Casualty Co. v. United States ex rel. Rigsby, the court will consider whether violation of the sealing provisions by an FCA relator justifies dismissal of the action. The court has a few other cases raising constitutional rights. The court will hear Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia, Inc. v. Pauley, a religious freedom and equal protection case, which asks whether churches can be excluded from receiving otherwise broadly available government benefits. And in Murphy, Wisconsin, a regulatory takings case, the court will decide whether legally separate but commonly owned contiguous properties should be considered as a single unit when determining whether regulation has deprived a property of all economically beneficial use and thus amounts to a taking. The court will consider class action civil procedure in Microsoft v. Baker, which asks whether the named plaintiffs in a class action can get an immediate appeal of the denial of class certification by voluntarily dismissing their claims. And in Lightfoot v. Cendant Mortgage Corporation, the court will consider the scope of federal jurisdiction over the Federal National Mortgage Association, better known as Fannie Mae. Fannie Mae has a provision in its congressional charter allowing it to sue or be sued in any court of competent jurisdiction, state or federal. Does this language grant federal courts jurisdiction over every case involving Fannie Mae? Or does it just allow Fannie Mae to appear in those courts if they independently have jurisdiction? The court will hear one bankruptcy case, Chizewski v. Jevic Holding Corporation, which asks, to what extent can a bankruptcy court approve a contested settlement that departs from the strict creditor priority rules that normally determine who gets paid first when there isn't enough money to go around? The court will also deal with issues of administrative law in National Labor Relations Board v. SW General Inc. That case involves the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, which allows presidents to temporarily fill a vacant appointed office with an acting officer. By default, the first assistant to the vacant post takes over, but the president can optionally override this by designating certain other officials to serve in the acting role. But another provision of the Federal Vacancies Reform Act places limitations on who may be appointed as an acting officer. The question in this case is whether this limitation applies only to first assistants automatically assuming the acting position, or does it also apply when the president overrides this default by appointing another officer to the acting position? The court's docket is somewhat heavy with intellectual property cases, with 3 patent cases and 1 copyright case. In SCA Hygiene Products Oxybelag v. First Quality Baby Products LLC, the court considers whether the defense of latches may bar a claim for patent infringement brought within the Patent Act's 6-year statute of limitations. Latches is an equitable doctrine that can deny relief when a party waits too long to sue. In Samsung Electronics Co. v. Apple, the court will determine whether a party that infringes a design patent can be forced to disgorge its entire profits for the infringing product or only those profits attributable to the infringed patent. And in Life Technologies Corporation v. Promega Corporation, the court will consider whether U.S. law applies to a product manufactured and sold outside of the U.S. that would have been infringing had it been made and sold within the U.S. when its only connection to the U.S. is that one of its components was manufactured in the U.S. The copyright case, Star Athletica LLC v. Varsity Brands Inc., asks the court to explain the test for distinguishing between utilitarian design features, which are not protected by copyright, and ornamental features, which are covered. Specifically, are the stripes and patterns on a cheerleading uniform utilitarian, that is, necessary for the function of a cheerleading uniform, or purely ornamental? Finally, the court will hear 2 different election redistricting cases that raise similar issues concerning racial gerrymandering. In both Bethune-Hill v. Virginia State Board of Elections and McCrory v. Harris, the court is asked to clarify when the use of race in drawing electoral districts means that race was the predominant factor violating equal protection. Both cases ask whether the need to comply with the Voting Rights Act can justify the race-based lines that were drawn. And that's it for the court's docket so far. Again, we'll be looking at each of these cases in more detail as the term progresses. Although the official start of the term is the first Monday in October, the justices have their first conference a week earlier on September 26th. At this conference, referred to as the Long Conference, the court will consider a huge number of cert petitions that have accumulated during the court's recess. Later in the week, the court is expected to issue an order granting cases considered at the Long Conference, and this is normally the single largest batch of cases granted all year. Once we see the grants from the Long Conference, we should have a better idea of where this term is likely to end up in terms of the total number of cases. Throughout the recess, the justices have made numerous public appearances, both domestically and internationally. In the last week alone, the justices have popped up in various places. On September 19th, Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Stephen Breyer, and Justice Samuel Alito all participated in a reenactment of the 1794 Supreme Court case Georgia v. Brailsford at the Old City Hall in Philadelphia. Then, on September 20th, Justice Ginsburg appeared for a public conversation at Fordham University School of Law in New York. Video of this appearance is available online. Toward the end, Ginsburg has some interesting things to say about her experiences studying Swedish law, and in response to a question, she named Citizens United as among her most disliked recent decisions. The following day, September 21st, Justice Ginsburg appeared for a talk at Temple Emanuel in New York City. On September 22nd, Justice Sotomayor received a leadership award at the Hispanic Heritage Foundation at the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C. And on September 23rd, Justice Kennedy was the keynote speaker at the International Bar Association's annual conference at the Washington Marriott Wardman Park. Finally, on September 24th, Chief Justice Roberts gave brief remarks at the grand opening of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. The Chief Justice also serves as the Chancellor of the Smithsonian Institution. Video of the entire ceremony, including Roberts' remarks, are available online. In addition to these new appearances, videos of a number of appearances in the past month by the court's 3 female justices have recently become available online. These videos include Justice Kagan's August 31st appearance at the University of Arizona, September 8th appearance at Harvard Law School, and September 13th appearance at George Washington Law, Justice Sotomayor's September 1st appearance at Metropolitan State University in Denver, and September 8th appearance at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, and Justice Ginsburg's September 7th appearance at Georgetown University Law Center, and September 12th appearance at Notre Dame. Notably, Ginsburg's Notre Dame appearance concludes with a lighthearted opera tribute to the justice. Justice Sotomayor also recorded a message for newly naturalized citizens that was played at Ellis Island on September 16th as part of Constitution Day. Finally, iItaly TV, a media network devoted to Italian Americans, recently aired a video interview with Justice Alito that focuses primarily on his personal biography and his parents' Italian immigrant experience. The justices will continue their public appearances in the coming week. Justice Breyer will have three more stops in his ongoing tour to promote his 2015 book, The Court and the World. On September 27th, he'll appear at Meyerhoff Symphony Hall in Baltimore as part of the Baltimore Speakers Series. On September 28th, he'll appear at Symphony Hall in Boston as part of the Boston Speaker Series, and on the 29th, he'll appear at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, for an appearance as part of the Writers on a New England Stage Series. And on September 30th, Justice Sotomayor will be in San Juan, Puerto Rico, for a public conversation at the 2016 Animus Innovation Summit. Before moving on, a few additional notes about the justices. On September 22nd, Supreme Court reporter Tony Morrow revealed that he had sent an inquiry to each of the justices requesting information about their health statuses. Morrow received a single reply from the Chief Justice reading, "Thank you for your inquiry about my health and the health of my colleagues. You can expect to see an able and energetic court when we reconvene in October. The court's Public Information Office will continue to provide health information when a need to inform the public arises." In other notes of interest, a new website devoted to Justice Clarence Thomas has recently come online at justicethomas.com. This website collects in one place a number of Thomas's opinions and public appearances, as well as commentary about the justice. This looks to be a great resource for anyone looking to learn more about Justice Thomas's distinctive jurisprudence. The fall is also the season of Supreme Court previews, events where panels of lawyers, academics, and journalists discuss the upcoming term. Several of these events have already occurred and are available for viewing online. On September 15th, the Cato Institute held its annual Constitution Day event at which it released its annual Supreme Court Review, a volume containing articles discussing various cases from the recently concluded 2015 term. The event featured several panel discussions, including a final panel previewing the upcoming 2016 term, featuring Supreme Court advocate and SCOTUS blog founder Tom Goldstein, reporter Lyle Denniston, who has been covering the court for more than 50 years, and University of Tennessee law professor Glenn Reynolds. Goldstein and Denniston are two of the most knowledgeable and insightful court watchers around, making this a panel worth watching. On September 20th, the Heritage Foundation hosted a Supreme Court preview featuring leading Supreme Court advocates Paul Clement and Carter Phillips. Clement and Phillips discussed several of their most anticipated cases, including the Trinity Lutheran Religious Freedom case and the Salmon v. United States insider trading case. Finally, on September 23rd, the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western Reserve University School of Law hosted a conference on the Roberts Court's approach to business law issues. The final panel of the conference was a Supreme Court preview featuring Eric Murphy, the State Solicitor of Ohio, Brianne Gorod, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, and Andrew Grossman from Baker Hostetler. The panel discussed cases of particular interest to the business community, including, among others, the City of Miami Fair Housing case and the Visa antitrust case. In addition to these panel discussions, the most recent episode of UC Irvine's Law Talks podcast features UCI Law's Dean Erwin Chemerinsky and veteran Supreme Court reporter Joan Biskupic previewing the upcoming term. Chemerinsky and Biskupic note the ways in which racial issues play into a number of the term's cases. Finally, several written term previews have appeared online recently. As part of its annual Supreme Court review, the Libertarian Cato Institute published a lengthy term preview by law professor Glenn Reynolds. The Conservative Heritage Foundation published its own term preview by Elizabeth Slattery and Tiffany Bates. And a comprehensive preview containing brief summaries of each of the granted cases was published by the Georgetown University Law Center's Supreme Court Institute. But if you just can't get enough, this coming week we'll see a slew of additional Supreme Court previews. First, on September 26th at 3:30 p.m., UC Hastings College of Law will host a Supreme Court review and preview at the Lewis Meyer Auditorium in San Francisco. The speakers will include Ninth Circuit Judge Carlos Bea, Northern District of California Judge Beth Labson Freeman, and UC Hastings Law Professors Radhika Rao and Rory Little. Several events are being held on September 27th. First, at noon, the Federalist Society will host a Supreme Court preview at the National Press Club featuring SCOTUS Blog's Tom Goldstein, Georgetown Law Professor Nicholas Quinn Rosencrantz, Kerry Severino from the Judicial Crisis Network, and former Deputy and Acting Attorney General George Terwilliger. Then, at 2 p.m., the Washington Legal Foundation will host a term preview at its D.C. headquarters, featuring former Associate Attorney General Jay Stevens, former Acting Solicitor General Neil Katyal, and former Principal Deputy Solicitor General Daryl Josepher. Finally, at 6 p.m., the Georgetown University Federalist Society chapter will host a discussion on Supreme Court advocacy in the Obamacare cases, featuring Houston College of Law professor Josh Blackman, Jones Day Supreme Court advocate Mike Carvin, Bancroft partner Aaron Murphy, and Georgetown Law professor Marty Lederman. The event will be moderated by New York Times Supreme Court reporter Adam Liptak. This event isn't billed as a Supreme Court preview, but given the timing and the participants, it seems likely that the court's upcoming term will be discussed. Then, on September 28th at 4 p.m., the American Bar Association's Division for Public Education will host a term preview at the Ronald Reagan Building in Washington, D.C., featuring USA Today Supreme Court reporter Richard Wolf, Pratik Shah, head of Akin Gump's Supreme Court practice, and American University Washington College of Law professor Stephen Wormiel. And last, on September 30th at noon, the Pacific Legal Foundation and National Review Institute will hold a term preview at the offices of Jones Day in Washington, featuring Supreme Court litigators Ted Olson, Neil Katyal, and Gregory Katsas. And that's it for this first episode. Links to many of the articles, videos, orders, and other resources discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes at countingtofive.com. That's T-O and the number 5. If you have any thoughts or suggestions about the podcast, I would love to hear your feedback. Leave a comment on the show notes post at countingtofive.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at Counting to 5, or send an email to mike@countingtofive.com. I look forward to hearing from you. Tell me what you liked, what you didn't, what's missing, or how we could do better going forward. This podcast is a work in progress, and your feedback will help determine how it evolves. If you've enjoyed this episode, please spread the word. Tell your friends, share it on Facebook or Twitter, and please consider rating and reviewing the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you subscribe to or download podcasts. If you want to help ensure that this podcast continues, please consider becoming a patron. Visit Counting to Five's Patreon page, and for as little as a dollar a month, you can help make Counting to Five possible. Please join me again next week when we will be taking an in-depth look at the 5 cases the court will be hearing during its first week of oral arguments. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to 5.